This week's scripture reading is from the book of John, chapter 17, verses 20 to 23. It says, I do not ask on behalf of these alone, but for those also who believe in me through their word, that they may all be done, all be one, even as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. The glory which you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one just as we are one.
Good morning, Southside.
Good morning.
Morning. You know, when a disciple desires to become more like the master, I think the disciple must first learn everything he can about his master. The disciple must examine the way he walks, the way he talks, how he carries himself, what he does. Right. So I was a band geek in middle school and high school. I was a drum major, played the alto saxophone, and I remember when I was in high school, I listened to CDs of Cannonball Adderley. I don't know if you guys know are familiar with jazz, but I wanted to make sure that my sound from my saxophone sounded like his. Right. If you listen to interviews by Kobe Bryant, he'll tell you that he modeled his play off of Michael Jordan, right? Michael Jordan was one of his mentors, and he tried to play like Mike. In this type of behavior, it helps us act like those that we admire, right? I was watching the Olympics last night, one of the figure skaters from Japan was up, and he. And I think that the first place score at the time was like 160, and he got like 210. And one of the commentators said, "Hey, if you're interested in your child learning how to be a figure skater, you need for him to watch this person skate, right?" So there's that idea of if we want to be like the master, we have to watch them. But we have a master that's calling us not just to act like him, but to be like him, right? That's what Jesus calls us to do. Not only must we learn how Jesus walks, how he talks, and how he acts, but we have to dig deeper than that. We have to learn about what he cares about. We have to examine the heart of Jesus, and that's what we're hoping to do over the course of the next 4 weeks in this sermon series titled, What Does Jesus Care About? We're going to examine over the next four weeks, what does Jesus care about? What is at the heart of Jesus' ministry? And as disciples of Jesus, who carry on that same legacy of Jesus, can we care about those very same things and carry out his legacy as we embark in this world carrying out the kingdom mindset? So that's what we hope to do this month. Because if Jesus cares about it, we as his disciples must also care about it. Before I get into the sermon a little bit further, I asked a few volunteers this morning to help me out. So I want to invite them on the stage. Four members of the Walton family and Stella and Miles onto the stage. You're going to help me out. So you guys can go ahead and come on up. Stella and Miles, I want you to be over here on this side of the stage. And what I want you to do is with whatever is underneath this sheet, well, you can go ahead and let everyone know, because I'm sure all of y'all were wondering. But, okay, so with those blocks, you're going to create, you know, one tower, right? The tallest tower you can build, but here's the one stipulation. It's got to stay standing. It's got to be stable. So you go ahead and build that. And Walton's, you have going to build four separate towers using the colors there, and they've got to be standing. So you're going to try to build four tall towers. And while they're doing that, let's turn to our focus verse, Matthew chapter 28. Matthew chapter 28. And I want to examine one line in Matthew chapter 28 that stands out, that's important for us this morning. In Matthew chapter 28, notice the language he uses. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations. Disciples of all nations, right? That language implies that we are to go out to everyone, right? There's no stone that is going to be left unturned. There's no neighborhood that we aren't to go, that we aren't called to go to. There's no part of town that we should be afraid to go to, right? All nations means everyone. And in order to do that, if we were to go into all nations, if we were to encounter people who might look different than us, talk differently than us, that might act differently than us, believe differently than us, we have to be committed to build bridges and not borders. Because Jesus cares about unity. In order to build bridges and not borders, we have to care about unity because Jesus cares about unity. And how do we know that Jesus cares about unity? Well, let's go to our focus verse this morning in John chapter 17. Notice here, I highlighted in red for us, that in these short three verses, Jesus talks about unity three times. He talks about unity three different times. He says, "My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father." Further on, he says, "that they may be one." And again, he says, "that they may be brought to complete unity." All right, so we know that Jesus cares about unity because here in this verse, he's praying about unity, right? He's telling us that we have to be unified. But I can't help but wonder and ask the question, what went wrong? Because if Jesus cares about unity and he prays about unity, if we take a good, honest, objective look at our culture, we wonder what went wrong. Why are not more people pursuing unity? All right? Okay, if you guys have completed your tower, you can go ahead and have a seat. All right. Oh, you keep building. You guys have more blocks. They can sit down because they finished their assignment. But y'all gotta keep building. Yeah. Yeah, keep on going. It's this very same question of why not unity yet that Daniel Hill asks in the foreword of the book Be the Bridge by Latasha Morrison. We're actually doing a study through this book on Tuesday nights. But in his foreword, Daniel writes, he talks about the prayer, John 17. He talks about his prayer, and he asks an honest question, I think a valid question about the text. He says, Jesus' final prayer was oriented around a vision for unity, and he commissioned his church to be the healing agent that brings the ministry of reconciliation into broken and fractured places in society, right? Building bridges to places that we might not normally go. Jesus calls us to do that. But yet, an honest assessment raises more questions than answers. Is the church at large, and are we as individuals currently making any contribution to healing the divisions? Let me read that. Let me ask that question again so we can sink in. Is the church at large, and are we as individuals currently making any contribution to healing the divisions that exist in our culture? Or are we making things worse? Have we come to grips with our role in creating this divide, or are we stuck in a state of denial? The answers can easily leave us feeling lost, helpless, and hopeless. And so this morning, I want us to take an honest assessment and examine, why is unity so difficult? Why are we living in a broken and fractured world? And then we're gonna ask the question, well, I mean, really, is unity all that important? Right? Because maybe the reason that there's division more than unity, the reason that we're pursuing division more than we're pursuing unity, is because maybe we don't believe that unity is all that important. Thank you guys for helping out. And then we're going to walk away with some helpful ways for us to pursue unity rather than division. And I hope we can come out of this at the end of the day realizing that we are the healing agents in this broken and fractured world. That we are the hands and feet of Jesus to bring unity out. That it doesn't just start here. Because if I were to give an honest assessment of Southside, I'd say we do a good job of being a diverse and unified church. But it doesn't just start and end here. The walls of this building aren't the end for the kingdom of God. We are to go out and to bring that same unity and diversity into the world. And so let's ask the question, why is unity difficult? I think the first reason why is because the messaging from the world is division. That seems to be the case, right? What we are being taught and force-fed from our culture is that the way that we handle problems, the way that we handle disagreements, the way that we handle conflict is through division. Let me just give you four different examples. The first one is back a few years ago when Colin Kaepernick led a few other NFL players to kneel at the national anthem to protest police violence. Many people were calling to boycott the NFL, saying, stop watching the NFL, right, because they're doing these things. And again, when Nike utilized Colin Kaepernick's image in a TV ad, similar people were saying, boycott Nike, don't cancel Nike, right? Don't buy any more Nike products, right? It's that same messaging that says if we disagree with something that someone says, the correct method to handle that is to divide. It's to divide, right? It's called cancel culture, right? This idea that we cancel people that we disagree with, that we don't see eye to eye with. Again, later on, when the CEO for Goya Foods, he spoke out in favor of Donald Trump. Many people were saying, cancel Goya Foods. Don't buy any more of their products, right? And then again, a few more years before that, Chick-fil-A came under fire due to certain groups that they were giving donations to, right? And certain people were angry at the organizations that they were donating to, and they said, boycott Chick-fil-A. Cancel Chick-fil-A because we don't agree with what they're doing. But I mean, their chicken's so good that didn't last long, right? You can only go without Chick-fil-A for one day, right? And that's Sunday, right? But then again, later on, Lauren Daigle, well-known Christian artist, was under fire for certain comments that she made regarding homosexuality. And people said, stop listening to her music, right? Don't listen to her music anymore because she said these things and she appeared on this one show and we don't like her anymore, right? And so that's the culture that we live in. That's the culture that we work in. That's the culture that we go to school in. That's the culture that we engage in. Is that whenever you encounter an issue that you disagree with someone over, the correct response is to divide. Right, that's the messaging. I'm not here to debate the different issues of these individuals that I brought up. I'm only using them as an example to say that when we encounter someone who we disagree with, there's division rather than unity. And that, I think, is what makes the landscape of pursuing unity so difficult. Or at least that's one of the reasons. The second reason, I believe, is kind of related to the first, is because it's easier and more comfortable to pursue uniformity than it is to pursue unity, right? Those things are two different things, right? And here's what I mean by that. Now, I think it feels a lot nicer when the people that we are around look like us, talk like us, they believe like us, they vote like us, right? They hang around in the same places that we hang around with, right? They root for the same teams as us, right? When we are around people that look like us, it's just that much more comfortable. I remember whenever Brittany and I took a trip to Japan in 2019, we got lost in one of the most crowded areas of Kyoto at the most busiest times of the year during a festival. And we were using my phone's Wi-Fi and portable Wi-Fi device to use the GPS navigation. My phone died and the portable Wi-Fi died, and we were without a way to get home. But a really cool thing happened. We stopped at this bus station that was actually going the opposite direction that we wanted to go to. But a really cool thing happened. Two other Americans who are just as lost as us were there. And I thought that was like the most comforting thing ever, right? To find people that oh, you speak English too, right? Oh, you're lost too, right? There's something comforting about being around people that look like you, that talk like you, that are in the same scenario like you. And we tend, if we stay comfortable in those moments, we tend to pursue uniformity than unity. There, in John chapter 17, I want to go back to that because there's a blink and you'll miss it moment in that prayer when Jesus prays about unity. He says there, "I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one." That they may be one, why? As we are one, as God and the Son, as the Godhead, the Father, Son, Spirit are one. And we might look at that at face value and think, okay, of course, the Trinity is unified. But let's examine that a little further and understand truly what that means. There's a famous picture, an image I'm going to put on the screen here that kind of depicts this truth about the Godhead being unified. I'm not going to explain it in detail. I just want us to understand that the Trinity is unified, that the Father, Son, and the Spirit are one. Right, I don't want to take too much time talking about this. That's a whole other sermon series, The Nature of the Trinity. It's actually a whole other course at university if you want to go down that path and read those books. More power to you. But just real quick, what this picture depicts is that the Son, the Father, and the Spirit, they are all unified and they are God. But the Father and the Son are not the same. Right? The Father is not the Spirit, and the Spirit is not the Son. Right? The Father did not die on the cross for our sins, nor did the Spirit. The Father and the Son were not given at Pentecost. Right? The Spirit was. Right? Right? So there's this idea that the Trinity is both unified and it's diverse. Let me say that again. That it's unified and it's diverse. And often we think of those two things as mutually exclusive things. That you cannot be diverse and also unified. Right? You cannot be different and also unified. But God tells us something different. He gives us a picture into a unity brought by diversity, not by uniformity. Right? That true unity is not uniformity, it's diversity. And that leads me to the last reason why I think unity is so difficult is because we're afraid of losing distinctives. So now I want to point to are these towers that I have up here. So notice something about these towers. These towers over here are set aside by what makes them distinct, right? And this must be Lucy's tower right here. I didn't see her build it, but it's a good tower. But notice something about these towers, right? They're all distinct. They're all separated by color. They're easily identified, right? We know what sets them apart from each other, right? We might even say that the towers might have some sort of uniformity, but there's no unity in these. When we turn over to this tower here, we see this tower is unified and diverse, right? It's not separated by color. But what I think is difficult when we pursue unity is that we are afraid that we might lose what makes us distinct. Right? When we group ourselves into little silos and say, this camp over here, and this camp over here, and this camp over here, we get comfortable in that. We get comfortable in those distinctives, and we say, no, if we branch out and we invite other people in, we'll lose what makes us distinct. We'll lose our way of life, which is exactly the excuse that people used 60 years ago and 160 years ago when the idea of abolishing slavery and the idea of desegregation came about. The argument was, no. If we do this, we'll lose our way of life. We'll lose we'll lose our distinctives. We'll shake up the fabric of society and things won't be the same anymore. But when we pursue uniformity, we're afraid of what we might lose. But when we pursue unity, we are hopeful for what might be gained. Right? When we pursue uniformity, when we pursue division, we are fearful of what we might lose. When we pursue unity, we are hopeful of what might be gained. And in the realm of the kingdom of God, there's no growth that happens here. There's no kingdom growth that happens when we're focused on dividing up into silos, right? When we're focused on our inward group, when we're afraid of what we might lose. Oh, we're going to lose these people here. Oh, we're going to the attendance is going to drop here. Oh, contribution is going to drop here. There's no growth when we have that inward divisive mindset. But there is growth when we pursue unity. There is growth when we build bridges, right? By definition, when we build walls and borders, there is no room for growth because you've built a border and a wall around you. When you've built bridges, that by definition is room for growth because you're expanding outward. You're expanding outward. All right. We cannot cut out a square of the kingdom and call it ours and try to protect it from people who we might fear might disrupt it. There is no room for tribalism in the kingdom of God. So maybe we're asking ourselves, you know, why is unity important? Right? Okay, I understand why it's difficult, but I mean, is it really that important? Is it really something that we should spend our time being about? I think so. I think the first reason really, I mean, should be the only reason, right? I mean, that's enough reason for me. Unity is important because Jesus prayed about it. That's reason enough for me. But if we need more than just that, unity is the mechanism that our witness stems from. By our unity, by our ability to love each other, by our ability to be diverse, our witness is either heightened or it's diminished. Right? In John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35, it says, "A new command I give to you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another." Our ministry, our ability to make disciples, hinges on our ability to pursue unity. If we're not pursuing unity, if we're not loving others, if we're not reaching out, then forget this. If we're truly serious about being disciples and making disciples, we must be serious about pursuing unity, about building bridges instead of borders. So how do we do it? How do we have a unified mindset? What do we do in order to have a unified mindset? The first thing is that we have to empathize with the unique struggles of others. I think this is important to really hammer here. Is that when we have a divisive mindset, what we are focusing on is what other people say and how they live their life is not true. When someone comes up to you and says, "I've experienced this thing," or this is my life experience, this is what I've gone through, and we say, no, that's not true. You got that wrong. Let me give you an example that hits home for me because I do this all the time. When your spouse comes up to you and they say, "When you did that, when you said that one thing, you really hurt me," and you say, No, you got it all wrong. You got it all wrong. I didn't mean to hurt you. No, you misunderstood." Anyone kind of guilty of doing that? I am. Right? I've done that many times. Right? That's because we can't empathize with the struggles of others. Right? I think the reason is because we're afraid that we're guilty if we do empathize with them. If we do say, "That's right, experienced life that way. You're right. I have hurt you. Yes, you have experienced life. That is true. When we empathize with others, we might be fearful that we are culpable for some of that. I think that makes us fearful to do that, to reach out to empathize with others. But when we do that, when we understand other people's struggles, we're more apt to engage and pursue unity. When we understand that they struggle just like we struggle, there's a connection. Have you noticed that the one thing that connects us, suffering, is also the one thing that might divide us? Because we think my suffering is different than your suffering, right? When we encounter a group, they say, oh, no, you've suffered more than I have. Or you've suffered differently than I have. You've sinned differently than I have. Your suffering is different than mine. You go over there. Let me be with the people that suffered just like I do, right? But if we turn that around and realize, no, you've suffered and I have suffered, there's a connecting bond that goes there. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I think, said it best when he said, we must learn to regard people less in the light of what they do or don't do and more in the light of what they suffer. Right? We can't be focused on how people vote, what stores they shop at, what neighborhoods they hang out in, what they believe, what theological views they hold. But when we focus on what they suffer, what they've gone through as a people, as a person, as an individual, there's empathy. There's unity. I think also what we need to do is to learn names and remember faces. This is a big one. Because when we speak and this happens all the time, when we speak in general terms, generalized terms, often we speak negatively about a particular group, right? I've heard this recently, so I'll use this as an example. But when people say, oh, when those Californians move to Texas, things are going to be a whole lot worse for us here, right? Right? And we speak in general terms like that, right? I heard it even more recently. Someone said, you know, I'm not going to go drive out in the ice or snow because those Californians are going to be out there driving on the ice and snow, and they don't know how to drive. Right? I heard a few people say something like that. Right? But you get the idea. When we speak in general terms, we often speak negatively about a particular group, right? That's a funny example, but there are more serious ones that I could use. But when we learn someone's name and we remember someone's face, when we see them as an individual with a unique story and a unique way of life, we don't speak of them in negative terms, right? We know their story. We've done the hard work of going up to them and meeting them where they're at, seeing them as a person, not as a people group, right? Seeing them as an individual, not as a statistic, right? Why are you afraid to go to that part of town? Why are you afraid of that particular political group? Why don't you like that particular denomination or theological group? Why is it? Is it just because of something you heard? Maybe an article you read on Facebook? Or have you actually done the hard work of meeting someone, an individual who holds that particular belief, who votes that particular way, who actually lives in that neighborhood? That's harder to do. That's harder to do. It's easier to form an opinion off of a meme you saw on Facebook than it is to actually go across the street and meet a person. But when we do that, when we learn names and we remember faces, we pursue unity. I think the last one is probably the most helpful. When we engage in conversation, we have to ask more questions instead of giving more answers, right? We can't come to someone that we, I know how this person's going to act, or I know what this person's going to say, right? Or I know what this person's going to do, right? No. You'd be surprised when you ask more questions instead of talking more what people really are like, what people really do, what people really believe. You'd be surprised. When we form assumptions based off of stereotypes or generalizations, that's a breeding ground for division. But when we come with a clean slate and say, I'm going to ask questions, I'm going to come here without any assumptions. That's where unity is. That's when we pursue unity. Well, I think also it'd be helpful for us to come up with specific examples of what we can do here in our Southside neighborhood to have a unified mindset. Four different things that we can do here in our Southside neighborhood where we can ask questions more than we can give answers, where we can learn names and remember faces, and where we could empathize with the unique struggles of others. So here's just some really specific examples here as I close this morning. Number one, you can volunteer with Academy 4. It's a great way to empathize with the struggles of our neighbor. That's a great way to learn names and remember faces, right? That's a great way to ask questions, because that's all you're doing when you're an Academy 4 mentor. You're just asking questions, right? It's a great way. Carrie Rodriguez is our coordinator here at Southside. She sets us up with Days of Allah Elementary. I'd love to get you hooked up with her. Volunteer with Academy 4. The second way is, I mentioned it before, if you're interested in having this conversation outside of here, attend Chris's Be the Bridge class on Tuesday nights at 6:30 at the Connect House. We'd love to have you there. We're gonna have more conversations about how we can pursue unity in a divided world. The third way I think we could do this, and I think this is really important, is that we can monitor our language and our rhetoric on social media. Does our language and rhetoric on social media betray the fact that we would rather be in a divided world than a unified world? Would we rather be divided over political lines and theological lines and gender lines and racial lines, whatever lines there are? If someone were to read your post, see what you say, would they know you're a disciple? Or would they know that you would rather pursue division? Number four, actively engage people who look differently, who believe differently, and act differently than you. Like, actually go to those people. The next time you say a negative generalization about a particular group, go meet an individual from that particular group. You know what I'm saying? The next time you catch yourself saying, oh, those people are like that, or, oh, I can't stand those kind of people, next time you say something like that or along those lines, actually go and meet someone. An individual, a person with a name and a face from that particular group. It might surprise you. I think, and of course, the last one, pray for those very same individuals. You'd be surprised. The more you pray for a group, the more you love the group. The more you're unified with that group. The more you pray for a person, the more you love that person. You know what I'm saying? It's hard to be divided when you're praying for unity. It's hard to see people's faults when you're praying for them. And so I hope that we can pursue unity in these ways. And there's more ways than this. I just thought of this in just a few short minutes. I'm sure there's even more ways than this here at Southside that we can pursue unity. Right? We're not about dividing, but we're about unifying. If there's anything that we can help you with this morning, where there's going to be a group of elders and ministers gathered around the auditorium to receive you with love, with care, with unity, whatever it is that you need, we ask that you can come at this time as we stand and sing.